Hello and welcome to the F1 Feeder Series podcast, your guide to keeping up to date on everything in the junior single-seater world. I'm your host, Jim Kimberley, and we have made it through a crazy July. Although there are still plenty of Feeder Series in action with F4, Road to Indy and Super Formula this month, the big two of Formula 2 and Formula 3 are taking a few weeks off. And speaking of a big two, I'm delighted to say we have two of the best commentators in the Feeder Series game in this episode to look back on a weekend in Hungary and answer your questions. First up, let me welcome back to the podcast a Le Mans podium finisher, WEC champion and soon to be a birthday boy. Happy birthday for next week, by the way, Alex Brundle.
Ah, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the birthday next week. I'm looking forward to getting that Le Mans win as well, so you don't have to say podium finisher at the top of all the broadcasts. But it's great to be here.
Great to have you here. Going to be 1 year older, but never going to get as old as Fernando Alonso, and he's sticking around still, so not too old, right?
Such is the nature of age. I will never catch up. I will never catch up with Fernando, but with his new deal on the table, the man can't afford to age, can he?
I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit about that in a while as well. And I am also delighted to welcome back our most frequent guest, who I love to have joining us, and even more so this week as we look back on Hungary and the season as a whole. And I say that because he's the only person, to my knowledge, who has commentated on Formula 2, Formula 3, and Freca all in 2022. Welcome back, Chris McCarthy. You can't escape Mr. Brundle, it seems.
No, thank you for having me. No, it's great to be back once again. Brilliant weekend commentating on F3. Great to commentate with Alex for the first time. I think I jumped in at a pretty good round. It was the racing was absolutely fantastic. It was fair to say. I seem to have jumped in on two good rounds with F2 and F3. So any rounds I seem to jump in on at the moment seem to be going pretty well. But it was a fantastic weekend of racing.
I'll start the petition to get rid of Alex Shakes and Harry Benjamin, just have you there to guarantee some excitement. and finally, we have to forget Drugovic, Hajar, Boganovic, because the real rising star in the Feeder Series world is Michael McClure, who's gone from writing to virtual press conferences to the F2 and F3 paddock in a matter of months. Have your feet touched the ground this weekend at all, Michael?
I mean, I still kind of feel like I'm floating on cloud nine, if that's what you mean. But I was on the ground in Budapest for 4 days from Thursday to Sunday and had a really amazing time. First one in the F2 and F3 paddock, and definitely hoping I can get a few more under my belt. So yeah, lots of stories to tell.
Oh, I can't wait to hear them. But before we get into it, a quick reminder to like, comment and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. If you don't have time to listen or watch every week, you can still find some great short videos on our channel with our best bits. And if you are listening to the audio only version, please leave a review on whatever podcast platform you're using. You can leave a rating on Spotify and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thank you to everybody who rates us. It really does help us out. So we're going to have to start with Formula 2. And I mean, there's a lot to chew on across all of the series. And I know we're not going to cover everything, and that goes doubly so after Fernando Alonso's announcement a few hours before recording the podcast. But what I do want to talk about, though, was Teo Pourchaire closing in on a driver who now hasn't won for 5 rounds, a tricky weekend for Drugovic, and a terrific effort from Pourchaire, Alex. Is Teo becoming the championship favourite?
I'm not sure about favourite yet. I think it's a wobble mid-season for Drugovic, who had a lot of... You remember he came into the... As Pourchaire does to a degree, but Drugovic even more so, being one of the most experienced drivers in the field now, comes in with a lot of experience, and he's experiencing now a bit of a mid-season wobble. Pourchaire himself has had his difficult rounds, but really nailed it in the feature. And benefited from good pace. It was a feature race that was very interesting in terms of strategy, with some tyres and some cars really performing in various stages of the race. Teo managed to get a decent start and then make that work out for him. Then several drivers kind of fell by the wayside for him. But you know, you've got that kind of 20, he's within a race victory now, which seems tantalizing, but really when you look at the championship and when you look at the way that points are scored, is still a reasonable distance to the front of the championship. What it has done is brought it back to life again. And it's really a two-horse race now, with Logan Sargeant also having such a difficult time of late.
Yeah, and I've got a question here just about Logan Sargeant's rookie challenge, because he was the rookie that was likely to be the champion if we were going to have a rookie champion this year. And that's hit the rocks over the last two rounds with misfortune, I'd say, and nothing from Logan's actual ability. It's been unfortunate in sprint race in particular with this one, and then the problem in the pit stop last time out. But it's another rookie name that I want to focus on for the moment, because we've got another rookie who's broken the 100-point marker after a double podium this weekend. Enzo Fittipaldi, he's becoming quite a force in the championship, Chris.
He did absolutely fantastic, didn't he? Out of nowhere now, he's climbed up to, you know, fourth in the championship with that third and second. It was probably one of the drives of the weekend, really. Strategy-wise, he played it absolutely brilliantly in the feature race as well. Stayed fairly quiet throughout the race and then came through to get second place. Just did an absolutely brilliant job with the tyres. But going along really, really well in a car and a team that, you know, are out of position, it's fair to say as well. I don't think it's unfair to say that. You know, we're not used to seeing the Chirouz car as high up the order as it is. So he's doing a superb job, is Enzo Fittipaldi, to be. It's not the first time either that he's been in a car that is, yeah, that he's outperforming. You know, I remember when he did Formula Regional and he was always at the top, raced with Prema, did an absolutely superb job. Since then, he's been with teams that are a little bit lower down the order. But I think he's gotten used to fighting that battle, and now he's doing it absolutely brilliantly. So, it's great to see, and the confidence he's going to carry from that. Now, I think the summer break's actually come at a bit of a bad time for him, really, but he's going to be going into the next part of the season really high on confidence.
He managed his mind really well, I thought, throughout that feature race. There were several moments where the wheels could really have fallen off it. When he struggled with the left front tyre just before the pit stop, was having a discussion with the team. We heard over team radio he wasn't happy to go any further with the car. And then when he came out, he followed the team's instructions and then came out on the medium tyre and really had to put his parks on under massive pressure from behind. And those two moments, beyond the pace he clearly had to extend then towards the end of that race, despite having pushed hard on the medium when he came directly out of the pits, those two moments really impressed me in terms of mind management from him.
He's really starting to just churn in the performances. And it's funny you say, Chris, about the Chirouz being underpowered, because I would generally agree. But the way he's managed to be consistent this season makes me actually think there's something with, I don't know if it's like we've got Drugovich and MP, and it's the car and the driver, and they're in perfect harmony.
To be honest, I think it's easy to forget how good Enzo Fittipaldi is. I mean, when he was in the lower single seaters, he was a really quick, very successful driver in Formula Regional and in F4. He was very successful. And at that point in his career, it looked like he was going to go on to take F3 and F2 titles all the way to the top. But for whatever reason, he just didn't get the deals with teams and, you know, didn't find himself in the car that he potentially wanted to get for whatever reason. So I think it's quite easy to forget that stage in his career. But when you know, if you remember that part in his career, this doesn't really come as a huge surprise.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see where he ends up next year as well, if he's going to remain in F2 and if one of the big teams will be possible for him. But, I mean, it's one of many stories. And you were the man on the ground at the Hungaroring, Michael, as I mentioned before. We've got Ollie Caldwell missing Spa after another penalty point. A crazy amount of tyre degradation, as Alex alluded to. Another Daruvala-Armstrong clash, this time with Daruvala getting the penalty. Drugovich's sprint race, turn one, dive bomb, stopping his two closest championship contenders from getting any points on Saturday. But Michael, what did you take away from the paddock after so many things happening?
Well, the three of the four of those you mentioned generated a lot of controversy because of the stewarding decisions, or rather kind of non-decisions with some of those. But no, I think I mean, a couple of points I'm just going to bring off kind of from observation. So one of them, when you're in the VIP lounge or wherever it is that you're watching the races, you've got the family and the friends of the people watching the races. And especially with the Armstrong Drouvelo one, they were sitting next to each other, the family of each of those. And it was actually much less tense than I expected. I mean, nothing, there wasn't like any sort of fireworks, any bad words exchanged, but you can really see when you've got those people so close to the sport, how much it matters to them. During the wet F3 races, which I'll talk about later, the parents sitting there, like quite literally biting their nails, almost tearing their hair out, wondering if their children, their siblings, their friends are going to make it through, are going to crash in those difficult conditions. And that's a side of the sport that you don't really see very often. And is, I think those human stories are what is so interesting in this sport. But yeah, touching on another one, I mean, Caldwell's a really difficult situation, I think, because he's not been a dirty driver this year, really. He's had a bunch of track limits violations. And it does call into question, you know, how do you police that kind of thing relative to other incidents? It doesn't make sense to have the same number of track limit violations in the sprint race as the longer feature race. Should the threshold be raised for that one in order to get 5-10 seconds penalties and penalty points? Why are there no penalty points awarded in some cases for collisions or for speeding in the pit lane? It's just some differences, I think, in how they approach it. That's kind of led to a driver who maybe, you know, hasn't had the best of seasons, but hasn't been the most dangerous, getting a penalty that perhaps isn't quite, I guess, commensurate with the crime. So that's been an interesting one to follow for sure. Otherwise, you know, just seeing the drivers and teams preparing for the race, preparing for when you've got, you know, wet conditions. Are they going to wheel out slick tires to the grid, or are they going to come out on wets and change when they're out there? You see that kind of live decision making just a little bit more from behind the scenes, and it's certainly very cool. And the last thing I'll say here, you see the drivers on screen, obviously, you know they're racing. Chris and Alex obviously commentate on them all the time, but when you're actually there on the ground, you see them a lot more as like living, breathing people. They're just like all of us. Many of them are close to my age, and standing there getting lunch, they've got lunch and dinner in like the catering unit. And I'm standing there in line. You've got drivers, some parents, mechanics, everybody. And it has very much the same atmosphere as like a high school or university lunch line, like a cafeteria, quite literally. You're just standing there and you've got a person in front of you who's maybe just engineered the race winning car. The person behind you has thousands of fans and hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram. And you're all there waiting to get the same pizza and pasta. And it's just quite funny seeing that side of it, seeing everybody together. And you know, you might think, okay, driver's really going to be disappointed after the race or really happy, but even a lot of the emotions just kind of like blend together. You see them with their entourage and see them kind of perk up after they've had a difficult day, or just sort of get that very gentle congratulations. And it's again, just nice to see that level of interaction that I think you can miss out on the TV when everyone's just kind of racing inside their cars. So that's what I definitely take away most from it, is that these are such human sports. Ultimately, it is a competition, it's a business, but it is ultimately one that revolves around people who are doing this, especially in the junior levels, because they love it. Parents who've invested millions in their children. And it's nice to see all that kind of on the inside, feel that passion.
F3, as ever, produced some of the most frantic racing action. Although some people in MP Motorsport might not be that aware of it, considering they were in a league of one at the front of both races. Chris, you're used to commentating on a huge grid, but this must have been something else for you. Two wet races, a new race winner, in Kyle Collet, a last lap teammate crash between Leclerc and Crawford, a newcomer starting from reverse grid pole, and I think I counted about 500 or so overtakes from Zach O'Sullivan in about four laps. What were the most memorable parts of F3 for you?
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, me and Alex were talking just before the start, and we saw the rain falling on the camera about 20 minutes before the start of the race. And I said to Alex, this is Ollie Girth. I messaged Ollie Girth the night before. I said, have you never driven the F3 car, have you? And he said, no. So I said, if it rains tomorrow, that's your first time, and you're leading the race, that's your first time in the wet in an F3 car. And he said, yes. And so So I said, so we're going to have a guy that's never driven this car before going from pole. and it just made me even more excited for it. It was absolutely fascinating. It didn't disappoint at all. Yeah, the racing was absolutely hectic. But like Alex was saying, MP had tuned into something, you know, something else, because it wasn't just Kyle Collette. Chris Maney was coming through the order really, really well. That's probably one of the best performances he's put in as well, the way he came through the order. Alex Smoliar probably could have done the same had he not had that contact a little bit further back at the chicane. And it was a fairly, you know, we did have the contact with Benavides, and then obviously we had big last lap drama as well at the end of the first race.
It was wild. And you guys were saying when the commentary just switched on that you were watching some of the cars falling off the track on the installation laps as well. Is that right?
Well, that was Ollie Gerther, who was about to start. He was about to start his first ever race as a, you know, in a Formula 3 car from pole position in wet conditions. He'd never driven it in. He went straight out of the pits and spun in turn 12. In one of the most impressive drives of the weekend was him clinging on for points, actually, in race one. Really, really impressed with that. And as you say, just MP. The others caught them up a little bit in race two. But Collette in race one, just absolutely gone.com at the front. That was a really impressive, really, really impressive performance. And it was good watching the field get the hang of it. The subtly long, slightly longer second race in the subtly slightly drier conditions. I sat there, with the mic just before that race started, thinking, how's this one going to play out then? Because honestly, I didn't really comprehend the concept that so many would stop for slicks. Mm. I remembered GP3 of old, and I remembered the driver meetings we used to have where, you know, one of the drivers would suggest a pit stop and everyone would sort of look at each other and snigger. And then loads of them did, not least Jack O'Sullivan, who starts hauling through the field so fast, the cameras can't keep up with him. That's what happened at the end of the race, pretty much. They couldn't find him. Every time they went to go and get him, he was further through the field than they expected. He was 10 seconds clear of anyone on his first lap out, which was a mightily impressive drive.
It really was. And yeah, I have to give a round of applause for Zach, because I was waiting to see him on the cameras and he never appeared. I think the one time we really saw him was on the pit straight where the camera just down to watch all the people finish.
So I was going to say, even the graphic to the left of screen couldn't keep up with him either. You know, he was two places above that, I think. You know, he was going that quickly. That it was just so incredibly fast,
Chris, not only was he hooning through the field, we also had a battle at the front as well that he was catching at a rate of knots. I think you said in the middle of the race, it's touch and go whether he's going to get on the podium here, and you were absolutely right.
One more lap, he could have easily got the win.
Well, by the end, when you look at it back, he was 5 seconds back from Smoliar. So I think he was about four corners away from a race win. I think that's how close it was. I had a little watch back at the last couple of laps, and you could see him in that drag race to the line, which again, that was amazing. That battle between Maloney and Behrmann was incredible. But it was so hard. It was so hard to know where to look, because we had battles. We had the ARTs battling away with each other as well, a little bit further out, which Collette was involved in. So we between two of us, we didn't really know where to look. So it was a four-man job, that commentary, honestly. It was so, so hard. We were absolutely knackered by the end of it.
I would think that Harry Benjamin knew what he was doing, getting away from that to have a little bit of chill out before the summer break. There's a couple of things I want to ask you, Alex, actually, just from a driver's perspective in Formula 3 as well. And I think you might have touched on it with Ollie Gerther's difficult start, let's call it, before the start. But was the race director being possibly overly cautious with starting under a safety car in the sprint race?
I don't think so, honestly. Those drivers have only seen a couple of wet races so far this year. It's a hairpin first corner, so you're dealing with a hairpin, then a switchback. And, you know, the drivers have not done a single lap in wet conditions since they last finished a race. I think actually the race director called that about right. The first one starting under a rolling start safety car. The second one, right, you've all had a look at this in the wet. It's fair game. Park it on the start line and get on with it, lads. And I'm kind of behind what they did there, really.
School of tough love a little bit. And then just a second question for you was, this year with the white line being so repeatedly said to us, this is a track limit. But in Hungary, it seems the sponsorship paint, which is surprisingly grippy, seemed to be the track limits at the final corner in turn two. Is that just poor inconsistency, or is that just we have to deal with the conditions we've got?
Yeah, a rolling frustration for me is that I feel that when these tracks are put back together, they basically shouldn't allow that. And I think it was in the cool down room. I can't remember which
Colapinto.
It might have been Colapinto that said, if that wasn't so grippy, we'd all be in the wall. And they shouldn't be in the wall. Where they should be is in the gravel that should be there. And it's as simple as that. I also agree, Michael, that dishing out penalty points for track limit infringements is harsh. You know, for me, those penalty points are for, you know, clattering into the side of competitors, ending people's races or doing dangerous things. You know, yes, I understand race direction are trying to draw a line in a tricky situation based around track limits, but, you know, by all means, take laps away, dish out 5-second penalties is the best of a bad job until we can get motor racing circuits which self-police these things, which is the way that it should be. But for me, there's no call for penalty points for you know, repeatedly going wide of track limits. You should just lose that qualifying lap or that position in the race.
Oh, if everybody goes off, then the positions stay the same. That's the only thing that I thought was slightly beneficial. It was especially at the turn two when they had, I think, the four cars you guys were trying to call, and they all just decided, you know what, the track's another 5 meters wider at this point, and they all did it. So I was like, well, fair game at this point.
Yeah, realistically, I stand by my point that, you know, they've got resource, they've got the ability to light tracks with 27 million lumens so the drivers can see if there's a fly parked on the apex of turn four. They've got enough resource to terraform these racetracks into racetracks that punish that. All you'd need is a one car width wide strip of grass all the way around the radius beyond the curb, and it would sort that. And I don't see why we can't achieve this, but it seemed between liability concern and not wanting to make holes in the grass or sweep back the gravel or whatever the concern is that we can't, which I find as a competitor and as a commentator, I find endlessly frustrating.
Yeah, not the only one from the fan perspective as well. Michael, Formula 3, the championship fight is the one in all of the feeder series that just continues on delivering. There's one point between Martens and Hadjar going into Hungary, and now they're on the same points leaving. And now the three Prema drivers could all possibly snatch the title in the final triple header after the summer break, assuming they don't take each other out again. What are your thoughts on the F3 title race as we're going to go into the final three rounds?
Well, it's been a very interesting one to follow because unlike in F2 or an F1 where you see a driver kind of almost running away with it to an extent, maybe not so much in F2, no one's done that in F3. It's kind of you get a driver, gets one to two races, and then they kind of drop off a little bit. We had that with, I'd say, Stanek earlier this year, had that moment after taking the win in Imola, has sort of faded back through, had some bad luck. Hadjar, I would say, had it Silverstone and Red Bull Ring and had a pretty poor weekend in Hungaroring. So you're just kind of getting these drivers. No one's really commanded it. It reminds me a little bit of the 2020 F3 title race, actually, when you had, you've got the three Premas and their Vesti, Sargeant, Piastri, and then you've got Porsche coming through. Who knows which driver will do a late charge this year? Could be anyone, really. Could be one of the MP guys after their great weekend. Could be somebody like Stanek who's kind of fallen off, or maybe Crawford after sort of losing a potential, I mean, fourth place could have even been a podium if crazy things had happened at the end. Maybe he comes through for a late tear. So you really don't know. And it's been cool to watch some surprises. I think Hedjar for everyone has probably been the surprise of the season, especially considering that High Tech wasn't so good last year. They struggled a lot. He's doing well. Crawford and Stanek also leaving High Tech from last year have made a big step up. So you're seeing some interesting names delivering and some names that really needed a good result this weekend getting that. Zane Maloney is the one who comes to mind, finally getting that podium, even though Sullivan, with what's pretty unquestionably the drive of the race on Sunday, sort of getting through and really turning heads once again with that performance. Can't say that his performance coach or his father were that surprised after the race. I was there on the edge of my seat. Oh my God, is he going to do it? And they're at the next table over. And his dad after this, yeah, I mean, it's a good race for Zach and get to go get him an ice cream or something after that. So it's almost like it's the expectation at this point that Zach O'Sullivan puts in a masterclass. But no, lots of good performances this year. A few drivers who really, I think, have had some tough races and will need to step it up. But there's a triple header at the end of the year for that. And I'm sure someone will come away from that with a lot of momentum and maybe enough to propel them to the title.
I do have a question just briefly on this, Chris, because I know we're going to run really long with if I continue going, but who's surprised you for not doing so well moving into F3 this year? Because you're so familiar with these names. Mm. And I'm not saying that in a necessarily a negative way, but I was expecting to see Gregoire Saucy taking several podiums for the year and so on. Is there anybody in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably going to be up there. David Vidales is another one maybe, but David Vidales for me is someone who gets used to a car very quickly. He won in his very first single seater weekend in Formula Regional when he jumped out of karting. He's another one I thought might get used to it, but Gregoire Saucy definitely stands out as the one. But what I would say about Saucy is he does take a little bit. Yeah, he has, in years gone by, he has taken some time to get used to a car, but once he does, he tends to go on, as we saw at Formula Regional, and he absolutely demolished the field in that, won it with a round and a bit to go. So he did get on the podium, so he's shown he's got the pace to do it, but I think he might just be lacking a bit of confidence at the moment. I think this weekend would have done him the world of good, actually. So maybe that's one of them. But yeah, just quickly on Zach, actually, it's interesting to hear what his dad said. I think I briefly said it in the broadcast, but when I first commentated on Zach, he used to do a kart series where I said it to Alex, you weren't allowed to run wet tires in the wet. You had to run slicks in the wet. And I remember commentating on him in that, and he used to win by over a lap sometimes. It was over in Belgium. So the first time I met Zach O'Sullivan, he was about 11 years old doing slicks in the wet all the time. So it really didn't surprise me to see him put in that performance at the weekend.
He started on the wrong tyres. He should have started on the slicks and he'd been winning the race.
Slicks all the time.
There are also three rounds to go in Freca this year, and Dino Boganovic has taken a sizable lead after this weekend in Spa. I can't have you on the show, Chris, and not talk about the championship. Mm. I know you obviously weren't commentating on it this weekend. I noted when I was looking for the results, it was a great weekend for Brazil, who Bortoleto taking his first series win, Dudu Barrichello grabbing his first points in style by getting some silverware. Any other stories to pick up on from Freca, both from the season and across the Spa weekend?
Yeah, I mean, those were the big ones. I've got to give a shout out to Sami Megatunov as well, getting his first podium as well. He's been someone who, similar to Dudu Barrichello, he's been on the brink of getting a breakthrough. He races for MP as well, so great weekend for that team overall. And he's just been on the brink of getting that breakthrough. And I've said it in broadcast a few times. Once he gets in the points, he's going to stay there. And Dudu Barrichello was the same. When you speak to him in the paddock, you can just tell he's down on confidence. And, I'm sure Alex has, spoken to many drivers who that just plays a massive part in a season. You could see it at the start in testing. He was really quick. Then we got to the season. He had a bit of bad luck. And all of a sudden, his confidence just went completely. All of a sudden, he's got this podium. I think now he really will be one to watch going forward throughout the rest of the season. So I was absolutely chuffed for him. Gabriele Mini had a really unfortunate weekend with the disqualification on Saturday. And that's opened up the door for Dino Viganovic, who, consistency for him is just been the key. And now he's really put one hand on the trophy, I think, going forward. So Hadrian David was unlucky, got a penalty as well, which got that win for Bortoleto. He actually did win the race on circuit, but got a penalty. So again, he's another one who's been just a bit unfortunate on a few occasions. But overall, the main story was Viganovic stretching away clear out front.
Yeah, it seemed to be a reminder of how it was at the start of the season when he was doing all of his domination. So, yeah, like Drugovic, he hasn't won for a few rounds, but back on form. And just correct me as well that it wasn't any sort of any problem from actually Gabriel Mini. It was a car issue that there was something wrong with the gearbox, was it?
I believe so. Yeah, I don't think it was a driving issue with Gabriele Mini. But one thing I'll say about him is he very level-headed driver. When you go and speak to him in the paddock, if there's been a problem or if he's made a mistake, he puts it to one side very quickly. So I don't think this will affect him. I think he'll come back very strong after the summer break, as Freca, of course, takes his summer break now and we come back in September.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun end to the season in a lot of these championships. Also on the other championships, we just don't have the time to cover properly. Michael, there was action across the pond while you flew the other direction. You, of course, weren't in American paddocks over the weekend for obvious reasons, but can you give us a run through what's happening in the single-seater world of the Americas?
Yeah, well, it's a shame they haven't invented teleportation yet, because then I could be going back and forth.
Racing would be boring, though.
Yeah, it'd be a lot harder to keep up with everything. But to give you an overview of four series that had races this weekend, beginning with Formula Regional Americas Championship at New Jersey Motorsports Park. Former F3 driver Raul Hyman continues to dominate that series after 2 years out of racing. But Dylan Tavella had his best weekend yet at his home track to win two of the three races and close the championship gap down to 51 points. In F4 US, which was also at New Jersey this weekend, championship leader Lockie Hughes took the checkered flag first in all three races, but he lost the first of those after jumping a safety car restart. That gave Ryan Sheehan his first F4 victory. Hughes now had Sheehan's teammate Bryson Morris by 14 points in the standings. Elsewhere in the United States, several drivers missed out on that New Jersey weekend to compete in USF Junior's Road America round in Wisconsin, where the Velocity Racing Development trio of Sam Corey, Nikita Johnson, and Alessandro DiTullio each took one win to close down on championship leader Matt Clark. And finally, in F4 Brazil, Pedro Clero continues his impressive campaign with two wins and a second place at the first of two Interlagos rounds on back-to-back weekends.
There's not that much racing going on this weekend, then, is what I'm gathering from all of this. That's so much before the summer break.
No.
Thank you, Michael. You of course can keep up to date with all our reporting on American junior single seaters on the F1 FS America's Twitter account and on F1FeederSeries.com. And just because you want more Feeder Series action, I'm sure everybody, I wanted to do a final shout out to the other championships we can't cover this week. Joel Cranvors took the championship lead in GB3 and previous guest Roberto Faria grabbed a double podium. Alex Dunn suffered his first winless weekend in British F4, still leads a championship. He's been on great run of form all season. And finally, Jamie Chadwick's remarkable W Series winning streak has come to an end after Alice Powell won in Hungary. But, of course, because Jamie Chadwick only has good news, she's extended her championship lead now to 75 points. So, well done to Jamie. But that's enough questions from us, because F1 Feeder Series is for you, viewers and listeners. And we're going to move on to the part of the podcast where you can have your say with hashtag AskF1FS. As ever, I'm sorry we won't get through all of the questions, especially with, as you just heard, so many racing championships on, but keep on sending your questions in. If this is your first time watching or listening, you can get involved by using the hashtag AskF1FS on Twitter, joining our Discord and using the podcast questions channel, or simply commenting on our YouTube videos and asking whatever it is that's on your mind. And we're just speaking about Jamie Chadwick, and this question comes from Jeff Spick. And they want to know, is Jamie Chadwick realistically going to get a drive in F3/F2/F1 ever? What's stopping her and other women getting into the current teams? And do we need an all-female team a la Iron Dames to crack it? Now, we didn't specify anybody on this, but somebody who knows a lot about racing is Alex Brundle. I thought you might be able to handle this.
So we have had a couple of all-female teams. Iron Dames, Richard Mill Racing, of course, were all-female lineup in sports cars. I think it would be... It seems to me to be unnecessary. I would hope it would be unnecessary based on the quality of Jamie Chadwick, that we would need an all-female team in order for her to gain a position in... you know, in F3 moving forward. I think that's definitely the next step for her. Finance shouldn't be an issue because of the winnings potentially again in W Series. And I think that I was just thinking as you read out her championship status there and the number of wins in W Series, it really is now time. I've shared a GT car with Jamie Chadwick at the Nürburgring 24 hours. She did a perfectly competent job. She was very professional, fast, and more than capable of racing at a high level. So I don't see anything stopping her now from jumping in a Formula 3 car. And I think that W Series owes itself that comparison at this stage, and indeed it's vital for the continuation of W Series and the viewer base, the sponsorship base, the general snowball of W Series, that the repeated champion now goes on and proves what she's capable of in a forum of you know, mixed gender motorsport. And I would really like to see that actually from Jamie through to next year. And I would back her to do a great job in a Formula 3 car.
I could talk about this one for a while, but there's a lot of questions to go through. So I hope that helps you, Jeff, with that. This one comes from Liam Talks Motorsport, who wants to know from Chris, how do you stay stood up during a race? Nice, simple question.
I always stand during it. I guess it's just the adrenaline of commentating on a race like you saw at the weekend, F3. They're very fast-paced races. And it's just something I've always done ever since I've started commentating. I've always done it. I think it's just the adrenaline of the broadcast, to be honest. And it's how I've become more comfortable. I've become more comfortable standing up doing it now. So not all the time. There's, you know, when I was doing IndyCar, I was actually at the weekend, I was actually sat down because it was just the setup of the studio was better for that. But I always stand up if I can.
Did you both stand up in Biggin Hill this weekend, or were you seated?
No.
Oh, always stand up where I can. Now I get the truth.
It was a joy to see Chris stand. I was always, I break the rules because, I can't remember. I don't know if it was my dad who told me. I don't think it was. I was always told you should stand during the broadcast because it opens up your vocal cords and engages you with the broadcast. But I don't. I like to sit back. I've got so much information in Biggin Hill. Normally, especially when we do stuff like F1 TV, it's great to sort of sit back and have it all in front of you. Whereas the tendency is when you stand to focus in on a screen like that. But it was great to see Chris up there in the action and standing during the broadcast.
I will just explain to the benefit of anybody who doesn't know, Biggin Hill is the F1 TV studio headquarters where these guys were commentating from. And then when Alex Jakes does it sometimes at the circuit, you guys are instantly speaking. I can't get over how quick you do it all. It's fantastic, fantastic stuff to listen to. We've got this question from the JGG on Discord for you, Chris. What was the hardest thing about covering F3 and how was it compared to F2?
The hardest thing about covering F3.
And how much time did you have to get prepared for it as well? Just a quick question on my side as well.
I knew I was doing F3 for quite a long time, but I had a couple of weeks off between one gig and the other sort of 2.5 weeks. And because I had IndyCar as well, I spent a week getting ready for F3 and then a week getting ready for IndyCar. And I guess the hardest thing about it was that there'd already been 5 rounds completed. So I'd already watched every round, but it was going back to watch every round again and just making sure I was on top of the stories of the championship, the stories of the races so far, and yeah, the stories of the season, because it is hard to jump into a season and know the story of Kyle Collett and how his season has gone so far, the highs and the lows so far. So yeah, that was probably the hardest thing. The difference to F2, it was probably a little bit more straightforward because you didn't have the difference in tyres, the pit stops. It was like doing Freca, really. It was, you know, it's a sprint race to the line. It's 30 minutes, or no, 40 minutes and 45 minutes. Sprint race to the line. 9 of them were in Freca last year. And I know most of them from, you know, when I was commentating in Formula Renault karting. So that gave me a bit of a head start, really. But that was probably the hardest thing. But if you're following, if you go out, if you want to commentate on a championship, my advice there would be, if you want to commentate on a championship, just watch it. And I'd been going out my way to watch F3 for a number of years. So when I got the call up to do it, I was kind of halfway there already.
I still don't know how commentators do it. I tried my hand at doing some sim racing stuff and the amount of things going on at any given moment. And that's sim racing. You've got 30, yeah, you've got how many cars in Freca? 36 cars in Freca to try and keep on top of.
Yeah, well, I make spotters guides, actually. And that's how I know what they all, who is who, basically. So, I'll show you.
Some great audio-only stuff here. So just to describe it, we've got 12 cars with a spotter's guide right next to him. Is that the F3 one as well?
Yeah, so that's my F3 one. There's Freca.
Lovely show and tell.
Yeah, and I've got F2 in there as well. Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I just make those. And I we have a whiteboard at Biggin Hill that I just stick them all on the whiteboard. I don't go anywhere. I have this tape, which I don't go anywhere without. And I just stick them all on there along with a load of notes. And that's basically how I do it.
So it sounds like a lot of preparation really helps you out. There's the question here as well, which is from Sam. And I'm going to ask this one to you, Michael. They've asked, do you think there should be an age limit to F2 or F3? Personally, they think there should be on all races entered.
That's a really interesting question. I would say, this is going to be a bit of an unpopular opinion, I would say no on the age limit. There will be a certain level at which drivers are not going to enter F2 because it is functionally a feeder series to F1. It's not really going to be useful for someone who is not at that stage. But you see with drivers like Roberto Meri's just come back. I know he's a substitute, but that seat might be empty or it might be occupied by somebody who's really not prepared for F2 if he hadn't been able to do that. So cases like that are where I'd say you shouldn't put one in and no maximum limit. I think the minimum limit is actually where I think we could have more of a discussion about this, because it is great to see a young talent making their way up the ranks. But at the same time, these are still kids, basically. And many of them are sacrificing their education and their teenage years to do this. And I think it's something that, you know, we do want to think about. For some of these drivers, what happens if their career doesn't amount to anything, if they have to stop and they've stopped halfway through high school or not even made it to that? What are they going to do at that point? And having kind of this downward trend and sort of when people start to move up these levels, I think can bring with it a kind of dangerous element in that you're essentially encouraging people to put even more of their lives on hold, which I know it's their career, what they want to do, but it comes with this extra danger. And even let's think about PR situations. How does a 16 or 17 year old driver handle something? We've seen some pretty uncomfortable situations in F2 and F3 this year. How does someone at that age like realistically handle that? It's not easy. And in a world where you've got so much exposure on them, I think having any sort of upper limit isn't really a bad thing, because those are going to be people who are, you know, more mature, more able to handle that. I think if anything, making sure that lower limit stays in place is what I personally think is the right way to go about this.
Age limits, but at the bottom. A question here from a terrific name of Johnny Oberman on Discord. For you, Alex, they want to know, can you ask what happened in Le Mans and why the sister car was so much faster of yours?
Yeah, we had a bit of an engine issue, basically, throughout the whole race. And we carried that issue from the beginning of Le Mans. There was a bit of gearbox drag as well. So those two things culminated in our car being a little bit slower throughout the whole race, both me and Esteban, which was a bit of a shame. But it's Le Mans. What are you going to do? Take the engine out in the middle of the race? No, you're not, are you? So we continued on, had a coil failure in the middle of the race, and that was an issue as well. So not the best Le Mans for us, but we came back for a fourth place in Monza, which is nice.
I'm sure you'll be continuing on to do it next year as well, of your impressive record doing it.
Yeah, I'm already re-signed, so should be back at Le Mans next year.
Great to hear. Got this question here from CM Parfait 16, who wants to know about you, Alex, what your thoughts are on drivers without an F1 team link who do well anyway in current situations such as Drugovich. Is it so imperative for an F1 team to take these type of guys under their wing before they win the F2 championship?
I think that there's a lot of not invented here syndrome that goes on with these kind of drivers. And it's the problem that they have are once those in charge of these academy systems invest in a certain driver, they almost have to prove their prophecy true in order to maintain their status as those in charge of those programs. So that's one thing that really holds drivers of that level who do achieve things back. Another, you know, the whole academy also have to prove their relevance, you know, year on year as they feed drivers into the base of Formula One teams. So it's a real challenge for those drivers who get all the way through that system and perform well. Realistically, jumping into the side of an F1 academy is, I believe, the only way through to the next level or having an affiliation in some way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that academy have to start funding your motorsport. Indeed, many of those academies offer an affiliation, but they don't actually fund anything. So I think it's very possible to sort of grab in a little bit the way Roy Nassani did with Williams, kind of grab an affiliation while, you know, coming in the side door of those academies. But yes, I do think, in answer to the direct question, I do think it is something that could potentially hold a driver like Drugovich back.
Yeah, I did see some rumours with Aston Martin having so many conversations this weekend that it was some conversation on Portuguese or presumably Brazilian television where he was talking about maybe doing a development role there. But it's tough, isn't it, for these drivers winning? What's he going to do? I know there's a lot of IndyCar talk as well, but interested to see where Drugovich ends up next year, irrespective of him winning the championship. There's a question for all three of you here. So I'm going to go Chris, Michael, Alex from Venus. Which feeder series driver would you trust to be your Pirelli hot laps driver? I loved that question. Just which of the ones from the feeder series would you want to have you drive yourself? Whichever circuit, but which driver do you want?
So drive me around for some hot laps.
Yeah, Pirelli hot laps that they've got these days, and they're meant to scare you as they go around the racetrack.
I'm gonna go loyal to the Formula Regional European Championship by Alpine. I'm gonna go with Dino Beganovic as the championship leader. Let's go for that.
Such a company man. How about yourself, Michael?
Goodness, I don't know how to answer this one either. On the basis of this weekend, let's say it's at the Hungara Ring. You've got to go with Ayumu Iwasa after that pole position lap. That was something special.
I like that. I like that as well. And Alex, you'll be giving the tips out, I presume, if you were going to be in the passenger seat.
Ayumu Iwasa is a good call. He is a good call. I think he'd be fun to go around the track with. But Marcus Armstrong always seems very sensible. He seems too sensible, doesn't he, to be uh, to, to to be aggressive enough. But we could, you know, food tips would be coming out of him left, right, and center. And I think I'd have Marcus Armstrong, actually. Yeah, he seems a bit kind of a cool customer.
Talk about food with Marcus Armstrong. I like that. That's a good answer. Let's go with this final one for this week. Comes from Finn on Twitter. What is it like commentating with Alex Jakes? He always seems on top of his game in the commentary booth and never misses a beat. This is for you, of course, the other Alex.
Yeah, Jakes is great. I mean, he has so much experience of the series over years and years and years. So much of the time he will turn or look at me over a Zoom call, as we do now. This is literally the way we do commentary. And go, do you remember the time when X driver did X and he slid slightly wide in turn 16, you know, in Saudi or, you know, in Bahrain back in X? And I have to be like, oh, yes, yes, yes. All that time. Yes, I do. Yes. And nails it. It is a relaxing prospect because it means I get to just spout opinion about what's going on out on the racetrack. So yeah, a joy to work with Alex Jakes. But honestly, I've never had a bad lead commentator. I've been incredibly lucky through my commentary career. It was great to be introduced to Chris this weekend with his experience of everything that moves up from, you know, karting basically all the way through to F3. A knowledge of the drivers brings me back into that world of prospect, which is super cool to dip back into. But yeah, I've had a great time with Jakes over the past few years, that's for sure.
Can I say, I was really surprised, and I know it's the case, but when you two said it's the first time you commentated together, it just never came across like that. There's just some partnerships that work so well immediately, and you guys just seem to have an instant rapport. I presume for both of you, you're just going in with another person who loves racing, and it's terrific to do.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, it was really great, you know, and getting the opinions of someone who's raced those cars before, you know, Alex has raced at that level. So for me, I love hearing, you know, when a driver's done something, you know, wrong or done something good, I just want to know what that's like. And Alex can give those opinions really well. So for me, it's great to, it's questions I'd ask anyway as a fan. So to get those answered is always really good.
The stuff Michael said earlier on the pod about, you know, standing there in the lunch queue with the drivers, them being surprisingly human. I really want to try and bottle that and spray it over an urban area, you know, and just get everyone to connect with that. And I think that once you actually personify what's going on, and they're not just little light bulbs in cars that get unscrewed and screwed in, and they turn up around the place. It changes the way you view it, and having been there changes the way you view it. I think it would change the way, I don't know if Michael agrees, but I think it would change the way a lot of people engage with motorsport, for example, on social media, to have the opportunity to stand there and see those drivers, see the heartbreak, the hopeful parents, the, you know, the worried mum, the everything that I know so well. It's a great reminder to continue to try to communicate what it's like to be that person, what it's like to have that experience as someone. It's a duty almost to communicate that as someone who has been lucky enough to have that experience and live the ups and downs of it and the brutality of it, which is the main thing, throughout a few years of trying to make it in these cars.
Yeah, there's a thing that people forget, that in motorsport, it's one of these sports where most people lose in a single race. It's not football where you generally got one team wins, one team loses, or a draw. Most people always lose in motorsport. It's just the nature of it. And I would stress, to echo those thoughts as well, Alex, that if anybody watches Formula One or presumably some of the feeder series we've got here, but only watch on television, go to whatever local track you've got. Go and watch British F4, go and watch Spanish F4, go and watch something. Go and just watch the tin top racing, and you get so much closer to the paddock, and you do see it. You see the spare tires, you see the teams, you see the catering truck. So terrific for Michael to remind us that not everybody gets that.
Can I just say quickly, Jim, when I was very impressed with, I don't know if Mike had this as well, but at Hungary for Formula Regional, we had people queuing up to take pictures with all the Freca drivers. So over there, the atmosphere was as good as anything I've ever seen at a feeder series. And for the drivers, they absolutely loved it. And it was an atmosphere that they, you know, for them, it was, you know, amazing. And as the commentator of the series walking around and seeing them, it was unbelievable. So yeah, they really did embrace it over there, I have to say.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I was there. I'm Hungarian, so I will say, like, that country is one that is very passionate about motorsport, hugely passionate about, let's say, touring car racing, world touring cars. They've got Norbert Michelis, who's like one of the biggest racers over there. And that's why I actually got into racing in the first place, because it was so big over there. I was there in for school in the spring. So it's a great atmosphere. And the craziest thing that happened on Thursday, just one other anecdote, I'm there doing a track walk on Thursday. I was going around with another photographer that I met there, and I'm walking down the pit lane, with all the other fans, and two people just see me. I'm wearing my F1 feeder series hat. Here it is. And two people see me and they start screaming, and they want me to go over and sign their like little cards, their notebook. They wanted my autograph. And I'm like, why on earth? I'm just a random journalist here. But you just see these people who care about like every aspect of the sport. They're just engrossed in this scene and in the Hungaroring and in everything it represents, that years long history of racing and of being the first venue behind the Iron Curtain. So no, it's an amazing place to see it from. And I completely agree with what Chris said. It's really a magical atmosphere down there at the Hungaroring.
I will have to take the opportunity just before we go to remind everybody that there is now an F1 Feeder Series merch store if you do want a hat. So lovingly modelled by Michael there. And for the people who are listening, it's just gorgeous. It's Arctic white with the branding, terrific stuff. So I'll put a link in the description and the bio. So if you do want to get your own, have a look at that. But for now, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much, everybody, for watching and listening. If you'd like to have your question asked on a future episode, use the hashtag AskF1FS on Twitter. Drop any questions below if you're watching on YouTube, or let us know what questions you have on your mind on our Discord. Look for the podcast questions channel. If you are watching on YouTube, dropping a like on the video, leaving a comment and subscribing all really helps out. We reached a milestone in watch hours this week, so thank you so much for all of your support. And if you're listening, leaving a review on the podcast platform you're listening on is greatly appreciated. Finally, check out f1feederseries.com for more Feeder Series insight, and follow F1 Feeder Series 1, F1 FS Americas and F1 FS Live on Twitter. You can find the links to all of those, plus the Twitter accounts for myself and everyone else on the podcast, in the YouTube description or the podcast show notes, as well as getting your hands on that merchandise. But until next time, we have been the F1 Feeder Series podcast. Goodbye. First up, let me welcome back to the podcast a Le Mans winner, WEC champion. Look at one podium finisher, isn't it?
I was gonna let you go, but we should probably have it accurate.